Siyazbi comes to the flavor of the month, as you probably know. Everyone's talking about it now. And it's sort of, if you look at what Bokori's doing and looking at this at the same time, you can see there's been a huge shift in NIH, which has been dictated to them by mandated to them by Congress, to really start doing stuff that's of more significance to patients and providers and less significance to scientists. So that's the context in which this is. And I was I gave a paper, and not this one actually, but in DC about 3 weeks ago, they had a 3.5 day conference on CER. And everybody who's lining up to now be the experts on CER was there. So I'll touch on that later. But anyway, what I want to do is give an overview, a little bit of what CER is. I'm sure most of you probably know this anyway. It's nothing shouting that.
But no assumptions.
Oh, okay. That's good advice. And then I'll actually offer a critique of it. I was hoping Martin would be here, actually, because when you create an avatar like this, you get to choose his underpants. And this one's got a maple leaf on it. This is a Canadian guy. I thought Martin would be pleased to know that I still have a maple leaf. Well, here's what CER is, right? It's comparative effective research. It goes by a lot of other names, too, often referred to as pragmatic trials as opposed to explanatory trials, or can be called head-to-head trials. It's the same thing. And really what it is a comparison of effectiveness intervention amongst patients in a typical patient setting with decisions tailored to individual need. And that's the key, that unlike a random controlled trial, this is real-world kind of head-to-head comparisons. So real patients in a real clinic with real providers that, you know, all average, if you like, or they may be outstanding, but anyway, it's in the real world. So that's the first thing you need to know about it. So that's a huge shift away from random control trials, which are very artificially created and are anything but real world, to actually a real world pragmatic trials. And the thing you need to know is the real key of the difference is the difference between efficacy and effectiveness. And NIH historically has been consumed by efficacy, and random controlled trials being the gold standard, right? What efficacy does is it treats something under ideal conditions, so you have very strict inclusion-exclusion criteria, and then, of course, you have a placebo control group, it could be double-blinded, you have random allocation of both human providers and the therapy. The problem with that is a therapy that has efficacy may not be effective, and the one you can think of really quickly about would be antiretroviral therapy, which in terms of biological efficacy is very good, but when it first came out, if you remember the complexity of taking the drugs, how often you had to take them, the cocktails you had to take, meant that guys that were shooting up in alleys for drugs, or you know, sort of the people who are getting HIV through exchange of needles, weren't really in a position to apply the therapy, and hold challenges in Africa where we know where you can stop the spread of the disease from the mother to the fetus if you can get them into the regimen of the drugs, highly efficacious and very low effectiveness. And there's no logical reason that something that's efficacious is going to be effective. And it may be because the skills needed for the provider are greater than what you'd find in normal practice. It could be that the patients don't ever resemble what's in the trial, particularly if you in the trial you have exclusionary criteria that takes out anyone with morbid conditions. So if you're saying diabetes, but you want to make sure they don't have anything else. Well, in the real world, they have everything else, unfortunately. So one of the things that's a problem with efficacy is you're a provider looking at this, you may never see your patient population in the trials just because of the way they construct it. And another classic example of that historically was female study of cardiovascular problems. If you remember, NIH changed the rules, so studies had to include females. And you know that all the original research was done on men. And we kind of know that the way that cardiovascular heart attacks and that present in women is quite different. And so we had a whole body of literature, none of which was actually done on women. You can see the same thing with psychotropic drugs on children, where they actually develop on adults and they're giving them to kids, right? So you can see lots of examples in health services where quite clearly the efficacy trials really didn't get at effectiveness. Now, you kind of think logically that something that's effective does have efficacy. We'd like to think that anyway. It may not quite be true because a thing may be effective not because of the therapy. It may have to do with touch, it may have to do with the encounter, it may have a lot of things contribute to effectiveness that isn't actually the therapeutic intervention. So you could get stuff, and there's a lot of people have suggested that with complementary alternative medicine, a lot of the outcome has to do with effectiveness and not efficacy, right? But anyway, so effectiveness has to take into account the total health encounter, and it's actually got to be grounded in what actually occurs in the encounter. And that's why I went back and said it's pragmatic trials or real-world trials, and in a way, like natural experiments, in a sense. You're actually taking a real-life clinician and live patients in a real clinical setting and doing it. So what's happened here? Well, it's really kind of, if you think about it, it's amazing. People like myself have criticized NIH for years, but the sort of classic approach to NIH is we want to know the mechanism, so we do small animal research. Then we want to do efficacy, so we move to phase trials, right? And then eventually we get to effectiveness. Unfortunately, eventually the heart never got to effectiveness. So they do the first two steps. And if you look at the way we spend money in NIH, it's overwhelmingly for those first two. That, you know, it's very hard to get if they don't think you understand the mechanisms, the biological mechanisms, even very hard to get the grant, they probably wouldn't let you do the trial unless they think you've got a pretty good handle on that. So this moved under the Americans Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which was referred to as the stimulus packet. I have to say, much as this is real money, and for people like me that would like to do this kind of stuff, this is really a great opportunity. Except that $1.1 billion is a very small part of NIH's budget, as you probably know. So we're not going to see a huge change in the way funding is allocated, except, though, that more and more NIH is really under the gun here, because they've sort of been told that they need to start producing stuff that's of use to practice, to providers and patients, and less used to scientists. So I think this is the thin edge of the wedge that you're going to see over time, an incredible change towards this kind of research.
I wonder if Harold Varmus has heard that.
Yeah, well, it'd be interesting, yeah, probably. Okay, so and you probably know if you don't, but where's the money going to be spent? Well, the part of that's been identified as the sort of home for a lot of this is ARC, right? But even then, if you look at what percentage of ARC's budget this is, it's quite small too. But anyway, they got a big chunk of it, $300 million. Then $400 million went to the National Institutes of Health, and $400 million was at the discretion of the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And so if you start looking across the agencies in the NIH now, you'll actually start seeing them describe this. And ARC has sort of taken the lead. Caroline Clancy has published with Guy Tunis, has published several articles now. She's publicly out on the road. She was presenting at this conference I was at recently. So she's become a very spokes kind of person for this area. So this is there. They're actually going to look at an effective healthcare program whose purpose is to fund research that provides reliable, practical data that can inform decisions in clinical practice. So that's what ARC's going to do. But even the area that I get most of my grants from is this one here. And this is the area that I'm really interested in, but even I'm now on the bandwagon. So they've actually put out an RFP, whatever one you call it, for comparative effectiveness studies. And you can see underneath they describe what they think this is, observational studies or secondary data analysis to compare the effectiveness or cost effectiveness of CAM in addition, so that would be adjunctive therapy, right? And then CAM or integrated care versus standard conventional care, and one CAM to another. So these are going to be head-to-head trials, right? And particularly in CAM, it's going to be increasingly CAM plus something versus, say, medicine. So it's going to be CAM plus medicine versus medicine, or CAM, you know, in combination with something else. So they're now putting their money here as well, and they put out an RFP that some of us went after, and I got one actually. Well, sort of. It's not really comparative effectiveness, but it was in the same.
One question, yes. Since cost is still there, is that...
What's that?
Is still cost, they're still interested in that?
There is, except, well, of course, that's kind of funny. They want you to study cost effectiveness, but they're not allowed to use it politically to make decisions. I mean, I don't know how you would do this without doing cost effectiveness. So the real kind of, it's just crazy. I mean, how do you reform a healthcare system without doing cost effectiveness? But you know, under the Health Reform Act, you're actually forbidden. You're not forbidden to do it. You're forbidden to use it to make a decision about allocation of resources. it's going to be used all the time, I think. So I think you're going to see a lot of studies doing it, Ron. It's just about what will be done with it politically.
And so I guess the corollary to that, I was at a meeting where Jack Rowe, he's the head at Aetna, was talking about this, and he basically said in the private sector, of course we're going to use costs, you know, and they're just going to assign their own costs to it. And the only issue is that the federal government can't use the cost effectiveness research in terms of making a decision for the Medicare and Medicaid.
But you're not actually...
They won't fund it. You can't write it in your grant because they would be...
Well, we're not sure about that,
you
actually.
You probably can, but...
You probably can, but it can't be used for decision. This is a really interesting debate because I suspect, and I've put a couple in already where I put it in, so I'm not sure that they will say you can't, they won't fund it. What they will not do and what will not happen is it's not to be allowed to be used politically to make decisions about allocation resources for the healthcare system. That's the thing. And if you look in the Act, that's what it actually says, right?
Well, I just add this. A bunch of us were in D.C. with Joe Selby at the Key Function Committee, CER, for the CTSI, right. And he was held against the wall on this because there is a call for proposals. And not even in this use of it, but the question was, you want patient-centered outcomes.
Yeah.
Isn't a valid patient-centered outcome whether or not the treatment's going to make you bankrupt? And the answer is yes, but don't give us any proposals mentioning that because we're not going to touch it.
See, my experience is I think it's going to depend on the agency a little bit because I think you will get proposals, and I've already seen many of them where they're in it, where you actually put it in, but they won't use the results for that. So I think, again, and I just can't see in long term how that's ever going to stand up. I mean, it's just so stupid. I mean, think about it. No other country does it in the world. And what's really annoying is America does it anyway. I mean, you think they're not going to use cost of... But anyway, you're right. I mean, it'd be better if you put it in to make sure it's not the key part of the proposal, right?
And the strategy I heard is put your proposal in for comparative effectiveness. The cost part is essential. Industry wants it.
Yeah.
They will pay for that extra piece.
That's probably
yeah. One of the other things that, again, I think as Ian mentioned, more political funders like ARC or PORI, because PORI just got started, are not going to touch it with a but depends on how you word it. And then the other part is that there's the common fund that most health economic people
that's going to. And ARC will probably not, because as you know, ARC was just about wiped out once before by developing guidelines. It was over low back pain, in which Rand had a role, actually, because Chappelle's study. But anyway, we won't go there. But anyway, they just about got wiped out. So they're going to be real gun-shy. So I don't think you're going to see them doing it. But I put it in because if you think about it, if you're looking internationally, comparative effectiveness research would always improve cost-benefit, which it would be inconceivable in Europe that you would do that. So here's what I think's good about it. This little quote here. It's put the P back in EVP. Because it's actually put practice back in evidence-based practice, and probably most you know, what's really been lacking in evidence-based practice is actually practices. Because the extent that evidence-based practice uses systematic reviews, and particularly systematic reviews of random controlled trials, you don't get the real practice into those kinds of studies, really. So this one, the practice will be front and center. So I've used this sort of thing about putting the P back in EPP. I think the first thing that's interesting to me as a sociologist is that it's a moving away from privileging certain kinds of evidence, right? And we've had this huge privileging of our RCTs to the great detriment of health services research, particularly because we don't do a lot of random controlled trials, but also I think just to the great detriment of anti-evidence-based practice, because I think, you know, when we've elevated to the gold standard, we've sort of forgotten that it's a hugely limited form of evidence. And when I was at the conference, I was talking to the editor of one of the journals, and I said, it really strikes me as very peculiar in America that if you look at the evidence we use to put someone to death in America, when do we give a death sentence, right? Think about the evidence, right? Now, if we've got DNA, that's fantastic. If we've got an eyewitness account, that's fantastic. If we've got a smoking gun, that's any better. But think about it. Many times, that's not the case. Often, it's indirect. You've got to prove motive. Otherwise, it's not murder, right? So it's highly subjective. We know that eyewitness accounts are about the most unreliable evidence you can use. So what do we actually use to put someone to death? It's the totality of the evidence, right? So we bring in all kinds of evidence, very subjective, very objective evidence, and at the end of that, the totality, the most compelling package of evidence is used to give someone a death sentence. It's funny how we'll do that. We actually try to be more strict about what evidence we're treating a person as in America than we are for putting someone to death. I mean, it seems absurd to me that if you think about health decisions, then shouldn't we be doing the same thing? Shouldn't we be looking at the totality of the evidence? And instead of actually saying, well, there's only one evidence counts and it's DNA, we're actually saying, let's look at the totality of the evidence. Let's look at how you bring this together. Anyway, so that's just my little thing about the absurdity of how we put people to death. But the other thing that RCTs are, as I pointed out, logically, even just thinking about from the point of view of logic, don't actually answer the question of effectiveness. So they're not actually designed to do that, and they don't actually do it. So eventually, if you're looking at PCORI and you want to have patient-centered outcome measures, but really what you want to have is patient-centered outcomes, then you need to know about effectiveness. The third one I think is really important, and this is going to be really intriguing for us, I think, because I think it does place centers of patients and providers in that above that of scientists. And that's part of the directive I feel is being given to NIH. That, I mean, all this translational stuff they talk about, but at the end of the day, how much of that real good basic science research is actually making a difference in the lives of patients and also in the practice of providers? And we all know that trying to translate the basic science into behavior of providers has been a huge challenge, right? There is a recognition that observational data plays a role, and I'll come back and talk about that. It does solve some of the ethical issues around RCTs. In CAM, you wouldn't be allowed to use CAM in a cancer trial where you actually just compared CAM to a placebo and where you didn't give chemotherapy or radiation for a cancer that we know where that's the standard care. You wouldn't ever get that pass an IRB. So there are some real major, and I would tell you as a person who teaches ethics, there's a huge debate amongst ethicists now of whether RCTs will actually survive. And the debate is about whether you truly have informed consent, because people put themselves in a trial with the expectation that they will be in the intervention arm, even though you tell them that they may not be, that they may be in the placebo. So there's a huge debate in ethics at the moment about how ethical RCTs are. So I think you're going to see that's going to increase, that's going to become more problematic.
But don't you think part of that is in that informed decision-making is actually being convinced as the scientist and communicating to the participant that it is equipoise?
That's it. That's how they're trying to answer, yeah. I mean, I don't know how that's going to turn out, and you wouldn't want it to totally undermine the existence of RCTs. I'm not arguing that, right? But I'm just saying that there's a whole bunch of really serious ethical issues that are coming up about RCTs, and at least with this kind of research, you don't have the same ethical issues, right? You're not doing that. It does, particularly for CAM, this doesn't apply to you guys, well, maybe do some of you, but for me, it does solve some of the mythological challenges of actually doing CAM research, which CAM really is very ideally suited to doing comparative effectiveness research. In fact, for a long time, I've argued this is what they should have been doing. Let's see if they have any outcome. I mean, what kind of effectiveness they have. If you then discover they have some kind of effectiveness, then let's reverse it, and then we'll go to efficacy trials. And then if it's efficacious, then let's look at the small animal model. But, you know, the patients and the provider, the biological mechanism may be, in some cases, very useful for therapy. Most cases, it probably is the last thing they need to know or want to know anyway. But anyway, you get average patients with average providers. This kind of research is more likely to have the kind of patient that the provider will recognize as their patients, because you're not artificially constructing the patient population. These are real patients. So if I'm a provider looking at, do they have the messy kind of patients I get? You know, the old standard, well, my patients are different, you know, mine more complicated. Well, these ones, you should recognize them there. And then the other thing that's important for me anyway, which is it moves us more towards whole system research. And as a sociologist, that's kind of the stuff that I'm interested in. So here's the bad. It's still a bit focused on trials, because they're still talking about trials. And it's kind of amazing to me when I went to DC. All the trialists are now retooling themselves as CER experts. Why should we be surprised? They'll go where the money is. Guys who have all their career argued that the only real study is a random controlled trial. All of a sudden now, overnight, are now singing the praises of CER. So I think it's still a bit focused on the trials, and I think you're going to see a huge move into this field both on what have been trialists. I'll point out, I'll tell you what I mean by it doesn't go far enough. It doesn't get at the health encounter, which I think is sad, because I think that's a really crucial part of effectiveness. And then I'll point out that it has real problems about replication. Because here's the major weakness of it. To the extent that you let the provider do their own thing, right, with the patients they've got, the extent the provider's free to do what they want to do, it's difficult to know what was done. So that's the first problem. To the extent you don't know what was done, you're not quite sure what contributed to the outcome. So you'll have a study, and the provider does what they like, you know, they treat back pain any way they like. You measure the outcome, and it's a head-to-head trial, so you compare NSAIDs with manipulation or something, and then you measure the outcomes, right? The problem with that at the end of the day, let's say one of it turns out manipulation is frightfully better than NSAIDs, the trouble is you won't know what actually contributed. What was it that actually brought around the outcome? And to the extent that you don't know what was done, now you have the problem of how you're going to replicate it. So it's an interesting kind of dilemma. There's a little piece of the jigsaw missing here that they haven't thought through very clearly. So they will be able to tell you what's effective and what's not effective in head-to-head trials. What they won't actually be able to tell you is what lessons have we learned that we should replicate. And I do military research, and so the military wants to know how we create this model if it works over the whole of the military. So they're really into replication. And most of the program evaluation I do now, the number one question is, can it be replicated? Should it be replicated? Right? That's what they want to know. So here's one of the problems, that we lack a body of descriptive studies that would tell us what the treatment and the health counter includes. And by the health counter, I mean from the time they sit into the front door, the waiting room, to the time they exit. All those things that happen contribute to the outcome. From the front staff, from the interaction with the provider, with the interaction with the assistants, and so on. There are elements in a sociological, anthropological sense, they're part of the health encounter. And the trouble is, because NIH would not fund descriptive studies, we're not even sure what's important to collect. This is the thing about medicine, allopathic medicine anyway, is, I mean, we have a pretty good sense of what happens in a medical clinic and particularly in a hospital, and it's portrayed on the media all the time and TV, even though they may portray it incorrectly like MASH. But the thing is, not that we don't have a huge sort of cultural knowledge about what happens. If you take, say, complementary alternative medicine, I say there's the practice of traditional Chinese medicine, how many of you would actually know what happens in a clinic of traditional Chinese medicine? And it would depend, as someone's going to tell me, about where if the person is really traditional Chinese medicine or it's a Western-trained acupuncturist who's just learned a few points for the needles. We don't know. We have no idea what these groups are doing in the healthcare system in the United States, partly because it's never portrayed on TV. You know, Two and a Half Brothers, one of the brothers is a chiropractor, you might have noticed, right? You never see him practice. Now, he's always the whoopy one. What's the word I want? The wimpy one, but anyway. So that's part of a problem. And that's added to by NIH, because NIH traditionally would never fund descriptive studies. You go to the National Institute of Mental Health, they won't fund unless it's a hypothesis-driven kind of research. So they won't fund you. And NCAM hasn't funded descriptive studies either. They'll tell you don't put it in. They won't fund it. Well, the truth is, to do really good CER, you actually need a huge amount of descriptive studies. And again, what bothers me as a person who trained in the philosophy of science, it's a real distortion of the nature of science. It's not even scientific. Science is always about discovery and explanation. And if you think of someone like Darwin, whole first part of his career is descriptive studies, collecting data. And so this notion that science is only about hypothesis-generated science is just a distortion. It always has been a distortion. So anyway, so what can we do about it? There's two things that we can correct this weakness with, I think, in CER. And lo and behold, I work in both of them. So this may be a bit of self-interest here, I'm not sure. The first is health services research would be one way of overcoming this, and I'll talk about why. And then second, observation studies. And I'm going to use observation studies in a broader sense than what you probably mean. I mean the sociological, anthropological observation studies. So let me just have a drink here. So health services research, since you guys all do this, you must know what this is, presumably, but this is for the Institute of Medicine. And if you think of what health services research does, it comes pretty close to whole systems research, if you think about it. So here's what it does, right? And you notice it evaluates access, utilization, cost, right? This is a key part of it. But it measures healthcare needs and risk. It looks at patient values, determines appropriateness of care, determines effectiveness of care, and it uses methods beyond. And this is the kind of world that Ron Hayes and I live in and have lived in for 20-something years together. It's very multidisciplinary. So the reason I think this is important is because I think it's the work that we do in health services research gives a real dose of realism to the evidence-based practice movement. In fact, I would actually argue even further that you can't have EBP without HSR. I don't think one's possible without the other. I think it's absolutely crucial that evidence-based practice actually draws on the research on health services research. And so I also would argue that it's absolutely crucial for CER. Because the kind of detailed information you need to know about the system, the structures, the linking the structures and the process and the outcome is actually done by health services research. I will say that the kind of observation data done in health services research doesn't do that, and I'll explain that in a minute, right? But I think the other stuff does. And so I love this slide. This is kind of what, if you think about the challenge for health services research. So I stopped buying stuff from IKEA. I'm always stuck with one piece and the bolt, one bolt's missing or one part of the drawers are missing or something, right? But anyway. So here's what this is what the definition of observational studies is within health services research and within sort of research generally. And funnily enough, that NCAM request for CER, when it said observation studies, it meant this stuff, right? And this is using effectiveness study using data from an existing database. And this is every PhD student we seem to have in health services research, this is kind of what we get them to do. Find somebody who's got a data set and do secondary analysis, right? I mean, that's kind of the model now. So here's the challenges of it, of course, is that it's non-randomized. It's not randomized. It can't measure efficacy, so you're not going to get that out of an observation study. It cannot assess bias, that's a problem. And it can't be pulled for analysis. Well, that last one, there's some debate now amongst those who do systematic reviews. There's a body of work that came out of Harvard and now elsewhere that shows that observation, good quality, good controlled observation studies don't exaggerate the effect size, which is one of the reasons that in systematic reviews they're always looked as suspect. If they're good ones, it tends to be they probably perform just about as well as an RCT. But anyway, they do offer a huge challenge. And you can see, because if you let the provider do whatever they like, you don't know how homogeneous the studies are. If you don't know how homogeneous the studies are, you can't combine them and pull them for a thing like a meta-analysis. But there are people that are working on this methodological challenge. So, and I will tell you that there's a body of a group now that are starting to make suggestions, the methodological ways of getting around that. But that's the problem, that kind of, well, that's not the kind of observation study I'm talking about. I'm talking about this kind of observation study. And that is where you actually use rapid ethnographic methodology to actually go in the treatment room and see what's done. And I'll tell you why I came to this conclusion. Because anyway, but what these kind of studies do, and they're usually done by anthropologists and sociologists, probably more traditionally, historically, by anthropologists, but they would go and live with the tribe for a year, Margaret Mead being the classic example, and publish for the rest of their career. But anyway, Susan Scrimshaw, who was at UCLA, developed a method called rapid ethnographic assessment in the 70s, 80s, which has been used by the World Health all over the place, and I've used it extensively as well. Well, you go and spend a day in a clinic and you shadow people and you wander around and you just look, right, and you observe. And what they get at in this kind of thing is what's called contextual analysis. Starting to look at what happens in the interaction, and what happens in the clinic. And they're looking at, because this is the theory that underlies it, is that what happens in the clinic is a negotiated order. I mean, it's not just the patient coming in and being giving orders and told, go here, do this, do that. That what happens is a negotiation going on between the patient and the provider, and they're constructing meaning. And everyone who's a provider knows this. I mean, you think about a stroke, for example. I mean, you get two people come in with the same stroke, and one is actually devastated by it, and one seems to recover and get over it. And if you want to know why, you have to know the meaning of the stroke. So what would be a devastating stroke for me would be something that affected my cognitive thinking. I'm never going to win a prize for beauty, so anything that affected my facial structure, distortion, is not going to bother me too much. As long as I can still think and talk, I wouldn't care. But so a meaning of a stroke, what a stroke would do to me would depend on my construction of the meaning. And in this model, we're looking at how people negotiate and construct meanings. And if you think of the effect of intent on outcome, this is why you'd look at it, because there's pretty good evidence within CAM anyway that people's intent is a really good predictor of successful outcome. You know, the expectation they bring in of a good outcome is a very good predictor of whether they have one or not. And then the other thing that's important about this is that the health encounter becomes a unit of analysis, not just the therapy. So basically, the unit of analysis is care, not treatment. Treatment is just the therapy. Care is the total interaction, the language you use, the laying on of hands, the touching, whatever, right? All of that's part of it. And the thing that you need to understand here is that you need to put that into the picture if you're ever going to know about effectiveness, and particularly if you're ever going to replicate it. Because if you don't know the contribution of the context or the encounter, you don't know what the outcome, what's causing the outcome. And it's kind of funny, if you've been following what's happening in NIH, and particularly in CAM, there's a huge move to doing studies on placebo. There's now a new move to looking at non-specific effects, and now the latest one is to looking at context. And they're starting to sort out that placebo and context are not the same thing. That there are very systematic outcomes that occur because of the way in which the encounters are structured, like hands-on, for example, hands-on treatment, laying on the hands, that is not placebo, and it has to do with context, right? And the reason I just got a recent grant, I just got a grant from NCAM to actually study assessment methods for getting at that context, to see if you can get a systematic way of doing that, right? And we're studying osteopaths and chiropractors on manipulation to do it. So the thing the reason I came to this conclusion was there's one group, and it's in CAM, where we have a real big body of health services research, a very large body now, and we have a huge body of sociological, anthropological observation, where they've gone in and looked at the treatment. And the sort of health services research is the sort of stuff that Shakal and I did at RAND, where we did a huge number of studies on chiropractic, and you've seen his publications, right? And if you look at Paul's publications, you'd actually come to the conclusion that chiropractic is a subspecialty. They treat three major conditions, account for like 70% of everything in the waiting room, and they overwhelmingly manipulate, and so it looks like a very narrow specialty, right? And that's kind of the view you get from health services research. And there's about 200 major articles now on health services research on chiropractic. It's the most studied by far. If you then go to look at what people like myself have done and other anthropologists, where we've actually gone and looked at the treatment, you'd actually think it's a totally different animal that they're describing. Because for the sociological point of view, you see a very holistic paradigm, it's very broad scope, and it's a wellness practitioner. So if you're in the treatment room, if you sit in the waiting room and ask the patient, what are you here for, they'll say low back pain. If you look what's built, you'll see low back pain. So if you do all this traditional health services research, you'll say, okay, it's low back pain. Then you go into the treatment room and you watch what happens, and then what the chiropractor will do is say, you've had a really bad day, haven't you? And you say, how do you know that? And he just pushes a pressure point, and you say, oh. Because we tend to store our tension in our musculature. And so he starts doing pressure point therapy. And you say, what's happening in your life, right? So now we start talking about what's happening at work. So now he's starting to talk about stress. And then you're saying, look, how do you sleep? Oh, well, I lie on my stomach, I've got three pillars under my chin. Well, okay, we're going to change that. What you actually see is manipulation given within a wellness paradigm. Now, if you're talking about outcome, which one contributed the most outcome? Is it the fact that I talked about your nutrition, your diet, your weight, your stress, how you sit at a computer, or is it the fact that I gave you manipulation? Right? Well, if you think about the total health encounter, it's the total encounter, right? All of those elements are contributing to the outcome, and it's debatable about which one contributes the most. In terms of quality of life, and particularly if you put CORI, patient-centered outcome measurements, which one would you measure, right? So this sort of, at least for me, brought home to me the point that the traditional observation studies that we do in health services research is insufficient. It doesn't really get it. If you actually don't go in the treatment room and actually watch and observe in this anthropological way, you actually don't know. And if you actually use health services research for concluding what you think chiropractic is, you'll never understand chiropractic. And you'll never actually understand. You won't even know what to measure for outcome because you're going to be measuring the wrong outcomes. You need to actually observe it. And that is what's wrong with CER. That unless you combine it with this sort of ethnographic observation where we start actually funding to do that kind of observation so that we know. So I'm going to look at what happens in amongst an osteopathic encounter where they still manipulate, not the ones that don't manipulate. Let's take the ones that manipulate. Does it still look like a traditional osteopathic encounter? Or does it look more like a medical thing that just does manipulation? Does it look like a chiropractic encounter? Can we develop an instrument that would give us the differences between those encounters? And also would tell us what to pay attention to? What are the elements we need to take into account? So that's why I said that I think health services research is very well placed for comparative effectiveness research and adds a very needed component, right? It's, again, though, it has a piece missing. And then I think if you supplemented it with this kind of ethnographic observation, so I would like to believe that anthropologists and sociologists now are going to get funded for a lot of research. But the truth is, if we don't do this, we're not going to know what was done. If we don't know what was done, we won't know what contributed to the outcome. And if we don't know what was done, we don't know what to replicate. So at the end of the day, there's not much point in actually showing stuff that's highly effective unless you can tell me how to replicate it. I mean, think about planning of a healthcare system, right? And I think, so here's my conclusion. I'll just stop so you ask me questions. So the money's good. I mean, it's for someone like me, this is a great development, right? And since I've already got a grant now to fund it to do some of this, I'm happy. The focus is much better. So I think the promise is we're not still sure about the delivery. We have to wait to see what will happen. I'm just a bit scared that the old gang will sort of just drag it back into the old model of privileging certain kinds of data, and somehow they'll make it a new kind of trial kind of outfit, right? But I'd say it needs to go further. So I think my sort of conclusion is very hopeful that I think it was a really good change. I think along with PCORI, the two changes at the same time have been very significant. And I think we'll get some good stuff, but here's my final comment. For those who don't know who David Lowe was, he was a fellow New Zealander, actually, that lived in England between the two world wars, and he used to write a cartoon called Muzz and Hit, about Mussolini and Hitler. He so annoyed Hitler with his... And he created this character called Colonel Blimp. And Colonel Blimp's a classic right-wing conservative character, right? And so we know that when if Hitler had ever invaded England... The first guy on his hit list was David Lowe. He was going to execute him, right? So, anyway. But I like to think that. So, is it a reform? I don't know. Will it change anything? I don't know. I'm hopeful that it will. So, thank you. Ron.
Could you say more about the ethnographic research? Like, someone might assume that should always be first before you go forward. You kind of implied that, but is it sort of just in tandem or what?
Well, it probably will be done in tandem, Ron, because they won't have the courage to bite the bullet and do it first. I mean, the truth is, particularly in the field of CAM, NCAM for the first 10 years of its life shouldn't have done anything else. They should have done ethnographic descriptive studies. They should have put all their money into that until we actually know what are CAM people doing in America? What are they doing? We don't know. What do they do for preventive care? I mean, even things like, do they take a blood pressure? Do they take a weight? I mean, what do they do? We don't know. With the exception of chiropractors, where we do know. But outside of that, think of it. Do we know what naturopaths do? Do we know what homeopaths do? Do we know what acupunctures are doing? Do we know what yoga's always doing? We don't, right? And there's no way of knowing because it's not portrayed. It's not like part of our culture. We don't go to an acupuncturist from the time we're born. We've all gone to medical doctors from the time we were children, right? Boys. So we've got a fair amount of internalized knowledge about how medicine actually works. We know what a medical encounter looks like, to the point where we even know if it's violated, right? So the doctor does something inappropriate, we've got a pretty good idea when it's crossed the line. For some of these others, we don't know. I mean, do you get a rectal examination from a chiropractor, for example? Do any of you know the answer to that, right? How would you know? You don't know, right? So so I would have said, Ron, if I had a choice, I'd have said, and if you think of it, think about chemistry, or geology is a classic. We have phylum, kingdom, genera, species, right? Think of how we built that descriptive chart and filled it in. The whole of evolution is based on that doing. The elements of chemistry, same thing. All the elements were identified, put in a chart, and so on. All of that's descriptive, right? So that when you come up with a new discovery, an element, you're sort of looking, where does it fit in the chart? Where does it box, or what family does it belong to? And think of species. Every time we come across a new species, right? I mean, I trained as a paleontologist originally, so I like this one, but if I'm looking at a trilobite or an ammonite or something, I'm trying to figure out, has it been identified before? Is this a new species, a new genera? Does it still belong to the same family? Who's it related to? And I have this incredible descriptive chart to do that. And when I think, let's take integrative medicine, for example, as an emerging field. It's all over the map. No one knows what it is. We've got exemplars. So we've got this model, we've got that model, and what we really need now is good descriptive data to tell us how are these models different, how do they behave differently, what do they do differently, what are the kind of outcomes that we might want to think about measuring because of those differences, right? Does that answer your question?
Yes.
So I would say it's probably going to be done concurrently. Well, you and I have gone through this, actually, because if you think of psychometric analysis, when you and I first started, you wouldn't get a qualitative component in, right, probably. Now you will not get an instrument published unless you've got to do cognitive interviewing, you've got to do focus groups, right? So we've actually, in that field, gone through where we went, we're never seeing qualitative stuff done, to now you wouldn't get it published without it.
Right. And
so,
the FDA is very adamant about the qualitative phase, yes, and documenting in great detail now, too.
It's still with that kind of research, you'd want the quantitative research to lead to a quantitative kind of measurement, because they still haven't bit the bullet, I think, to say that qualitative research has justification on its own, for itself in its own right, and it can be done just qualitative research by itself. I think that's still a tricky sell. And I work with a lot of people who have got into qualitative research, and they drive me nuts because they always want to convert it to quantitative. And I keep trying to tell them, if you wanted quantitative, do quantitative from a start. I mean, don't try and convert this, because the assumptions are quite different. It's based on different assumptions. So, isn't that not how many years? Yes, sorry. Vegas, from you?
I was just thinking, when you said we don't know what's happening, we don't know. Like, there is some literature in, for example, sociology and anthropology,
yes,
that suggests what does happen there.
Of course, yes.
And I'm just wondering...
But again, though, it's limited, Sonia. If you think of the number of ones that we know that for, where there's a really a substantial body, I mean, it just can't be a single study. And often, unfortunately, that's single study. So you go and do an ethnographic study of one clinic. So there's not too many where we've got a, you know, like a systematic review, if you like, a body of it, yeah. But that's where you'd need to look, yeah.
Sorry, I missed the first half.
That's the money part, yeah.
All right. Maybe address this, but I know you've published on this before. Mm. So two questions. One, the separation between health services research and anthropology or qualitative methods. Because I've kind of been of the school of thought that, you know, that the qualitative approach to describing health systems is health services research. Is there a distinction? You kind of will sometimes separate that. And so if you maybe speak to that. And then the second question really gets to this issue of the forcing of the quantitative part. You know, I've had other studies where we've tried to compare systems.
Yeah.
And we get into trouble when you begin to describe those components of a system, and the statisticians want you to assess the contribution of each of those components to the outcomes. So you know, the person will get, you know, a different diagnosis, an assessment. You may have all of these other components of that system of care,
yeah.
and then they want to know which one contributed to the positive yeah. outcome. And we know the challenges of actually being able to do that with sample size consideration.
So let's take your first question. The problem I find with most health services research, most health services research that do qualitative research have wandered into it. Gifted amateurs, I would say, in a way. And so if you ask me the difference between them and social anthropologists, the social scientists are much better trained. They're much more rigorous. They understand more about robustness. Like, I spend a lot of my time on projects where I'm teaching health services research about just simple things like how to code qualitative data. And I go over and over and again. And usually what I find is they've actually understood now how important qualitative research is, and they're actually doing it, but they've lacked the really formal training in how to do it well. So I would say that, and remember, not too many social scientists have become health services research. There is a group of us, I mean, Mon's an example, I'm an example, so there's a group of us around, so, and it's getting bigger. But not many sociologists have chosen to have a health services research career. I mean, I trained as a sociologist, but I haven't been a sociologist for years. No sociology department would probably recruit me. I mean, why? Because I'm not into this theoretical kind of, in this, in fact, I don't even understand contemporary sociology. I can't even understand the language they talk. It's just totally ridiculous. But they would employ me because I now don't look like a sociologist. And I'm not. I'm a health services researcher. I'm interested in selling and solving problems. And to the extent that sociology helps me, that's true. But I'll use stats. I'll use anything. I mean, Gary Ryan and I have this discussion at Rand all the time. Do you know what Major Barbara is? Shaw wrote a play called Major Barbara. And the dilemma of Major Barbara is she's in the Salvation Army, she's a major in the Salvation Army, and the question is, should she take money from the armaments manufacturer and use it in her church? That's the dilemma, right? And so, what she says is, I take it from the devil himself and only be too happy to get in the hands of the Lord, will do some good. And I would say that I'm a major Barbara methodologically. I'm not particularly interested whether methods are anthropology, sociology, psychology. What I'm interested in, what methods do I need to solve the problem that I'm trying to do? And if it's effectiveness, which ones help me solve it? So I would say that more and more you're probably going to see social scientists involved. What used to be called behavioral scientists, we don't tend to use that term anymore. Behavioral scientists really were social scientists that did health. I mean, that's kind of what the word. So I think you're going to see more and more of those kind of people coming together with a partnership in health services research. And I think a lot more health services researchers who go and get formally trained. So they understand, for you don't actually have to know a lot of phenomenology to do qualitative research, but it does help. You need to know where these assumptions come from. You need to know, you know, what's the philosophical grounding of this kind of perspective. And often that's missing. And it's like doing acupuncture without knowing about traditional Chinese medicine, without actually knowing in the philosophy. So that was your first question. Your second question was...
It was about the quantitative aspect of it, at least in terms of comparative studies.
Comparative studies.
And when you're comparing systems...
Do we have any statisticians here? I gotta say, well, the first thing is drown all statisticians. But I have to say, though, biostatisticians have a lot to pay up for, I think, because in NIH, on all these committees, they have had an extraordinary influence, way beyond, as we know, p-values, which we now, the tyranny of p, which we're now starting to figure out in a way, because we're doing these critiques, that they've had a very distorting influence. And I have to say, you just hit it on the head there, about they ask the wrong questions, they ask them in the wrong way. And I have to say, they don't understand the difference between rigor and robustness. And they're not the same things. Rigor is the kind of stuff you do with random controlled trials and statistical analysis, right? You're looking at rigor. So psychometric analysis is rigorous, right? Scientifically rigorous. Robustness is what qualitative people do, which is looking at variation. We're not interested in means, we're not interested in averages. So, for example, we don't think something's important because 55% of the people said it. We think sometimes important because one person said it, right? So what we're looking at in any kind of context analysis is the variety over the context, and that's called robustness. And rigor doesn't get at robustness. So I think amongst statisticians, there's been a total misunderstanding of the difference. And converting qualitative things into the numbers doesn't get at robustness. It tries to give you a spurious sense of rigor. So, okay, let's say 70% of the people agreed, made the same statement. What does that tell you? It doesn't even tell you if they got it right. I mean, it doesn't do that, right? Someone said that in this conference, and you know, that statisticians look at doing the question right, and sociologists look at doing the right question. But I have to say the good news, the really good news is now, more and more there are people around, and nursing has helped do this, by the way, because you know on NIH, some of the most influential qualitative researchers have come from nursing, and they've done training programs, and they sit on things and so on. And they got into qualitative research really. So did business management, by the way. It's amazing to me. You look at business management, they're doing qualitative studies. So I think you're actually seeing more and more, you're now seeing good qualitative researchers evaluating qualitative stuff, both in journals. Like, I get stuff published now that 20 years ago I had to convert into quantitative stuff. Now I can get stuff published qualitatively. I've got a show that was done with incredible, triangulation and really rigid kind of controls. I mean, and I insist on that. I have a hard trouble someone trying to tell people why we double code everything and all this, right? But I think if you do it rigorously, if you do the methodology well done, with a lot of triangulation to show that you were trying to control for any kind of bias, you actually can get good qualitative research published now. And the work that came out of places like Harvard and that now showing that good qualitative research is as good as quantitative has helped. So I think that's going to be just a time thing. Just as I said in psychometric stuff, where we couldn't get qualitative stuff, and now we won't get it published unless we have it in. And they're looking at the quality of that qualitative stuff. So no longer do you have to do cognitive interviewing and focus groups. They're going to evaluate how good they were, right? And we're starting to see emergent standards to do that. So I think this is just a matter of time. If you were talking to me 10 years ago and you're trying to get something published, I'd probably tell you, you know, try and sort of convert it into quantitative data if you can, because they probably won't publish it. Now, that's not true. So.
Thank you very much. That was really refreshing, refreshingly optimistic, and also one of the few CER seminars we got to the end of the slides, which was really nice. But I want to go back to your initial premise, which I think was suggesting that NIH is going to adopt the PCORI agenda. And I would love to hear that. I would love to believe that there isn't going to be all of this focus on this end of things and patient perspectives, and that isn't going to go away as soon as the PCORI money runs out.
PCORI's got the advantage it's not answerable to anybody, so it can do whatever it likes. So it's got tremendous moral authority because no one can touch it, right? Mm-hmm. So if they get it right and if they do it correctly, if it sits out there as this big elephant doing its thing, it's going to have an
influence. And if they don't pull the money out from underneath them, yeah.
That's true. NIH is in a delicate position because they're facing budget cuts. They're being told, but no uncertain terms. I mean, the message on the Hill is pretty clear that you need to reorientate yourself. And basically, if you don't, we're going to cut more money from you. So I think that PCORI was a wake-up call for them as well to say, listen, we need to move to either a huge amount of money on translational kinds of stuff or getting the research into providers' behavior and the patient, or we have to rethink this. So I think it would be very dangerous for NIH to ignore this. I can tell you for ENCAMP, it would be very dangerous. I went to a session recently where Josie Biggs was here, and one senator and two congressmen stood up publicly and told her off. Absolutely tore a strip off her in a meeting, the whole people. Told her how irrelevant the center was, about they didn't do what I was set up to do, and that they should be, I mean, I virtually told them they should be closing down. Now, it's not Josie's fault. I mean, she inherited this, right? But they've made it pretty clear that we didn't set you up to do the stuff you're doing, and if you don't do what we set you up to do, then we might think about closing you down. And so I think NIH sort of understands that threat at the moment. So if I'm optimistic, I think it's because, you know, I come from RAND, so we've got even economic incentives, right? So I think NIH will ignore at their peril. I think, in actual fact, now whether they'll just do it, give it lip service, you know, we'll give it $300 million a year and we'll do a little bit there. But I actually think researchers are interesting people. They go where the money is, right? Which is why they're all jumping over to CER. And it's getting harder to get money, right? Because more people are competing. Roberta and I were at this conference here on campus last week. Well, I think I might have said to you, Roberta, that the people at that conference 10 years ago, 15 years ago, wouldn't have been competing with me for a grant because they weren't in this field. They weren't there. Now, I mean, I've got double the number of competitors, right? So my feeling is that to the extent that this is a new pot of money and it's exciting, and I think there is a group of real genuine people who really, like me, wanted to see CR developed. There's a very big field of them, actually. So I suppose I'm optimistic. It's going to be hard, but it will also depend on the director, Vienna Hans. I mean, the director does have a fairly powerful influence. So.
And what do we do about the reviewers? Because that's the part two. You know, it's wonderful to say, here's what we want, but...
Well, I think you just keep plugging away. The one I just got on the health account, I've been trying to get for 20 years. I finally got it. So you've got to be patient, I suppose.
Until they get three chances.
Or survive them, you know. You get three chances. Two now.
Two
it was three, yeah. It's even worse.
Change their title.
Well, all I can say is that in the 30 years I've been working in the field that I worked in, this is the most encouraging time. I think at long last we're actually starting to see research methods that really are appropriate to studying CAM, that really will give us a way of sorting out, and I'm not against CAM being evaluated, I'm all for it being evaluated, but I want it to be evaluated with a methodology that's appropriate. And at this conference there's a wonderful quote from an economist. He said, "My logical model is impervious to criticism." This is my mantra now. My logical model is impervious to criticism. Well, the thing is, because the research on CAM was so bad, it kind of made the CAM professions impervious to criticism. Because they could say, well, you didn't study the whole system, or you didn't, you know. They could always have an out because the research didn't really get at effectiveness and didn't get at them. So I don't want to say they've had a free ride, because they haven't. But they have been able to shelter themselves from what should have been, maybe, good criticism from good research, right? And that shouldn't be true for anyone in the health field, even us, right? So.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.